This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. Once again, the subject of birds is pitting environmentalists against the military in eastern North Carolina. This time, the U.S. Navy and Marine Corps are asking for an additional 900 square miles of airspace, a military operations area. Much of it would be over Hyde County, not far from where the Navy wants to put a controversial outlying landing field. This week, Judge Terrence Boyle, the same federal judge in the OLF case, heard arguments from three environmental groups opposing this expanded airspace. Namely, they said, rare waterfowl would be endangered by the increased flights. Wade Rollins is a reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer, and he's been covering the airspace issue and the OLF. He joins us now by phone. Welcome, Wade Rollins.
Glad to be here.
Well, the Navy and the Marine Corps want what's 900 square miles of airspace for what it calls a military operations area, or a MOA. What is it exactly they want this for?
They want it to expand the areas where they do military pilot training. They're asking for two different blocks or boxes of airspace to be designated by the Federal Aviation Administration. One is over Core Banks and Cape Lookout National Seashore that would allow pilots to move back and forth between existing training areas that they have at a lower altitudes. Right now they have what they think they describe as a speed bump when they go over the Outer Banks. They have to climb up to 10,000 feet elevation, and they have to slow down to less than 288 miles an hour when they're moving between training areas. They currently have training areas over much of the Pamlico Sound and over small pieces of Carteret County and Pamlico County and Hyde County and some other areas around Camp Lejeune, and they have a bombing range in Dare County. So what they're proposing with the Core Banks would allow them to move between training areas, and they say it would provide more realistic training because they wouldn't have to slow down. The larger box of airspace that they're asking for is over most of the airspace. It's over Beaufort, Hyde, Pamlico, Terrell, and Washington counties. They call that the Matamuskeet, and it in fact is over Lake Matamuskeet, which is a part of the National Wildlife Refuge, and it's also over three other wildlife refuges as well. They're asking for the airspace between 3,000 feet and 18,000 feet to be designated for them to practice combat maneuvers, do various kinds of aerial training.
And so that's what brings the environmental groups in, I imagine, then, is because this is over those refuges?
That's right. It's over four refuges. This issue has been around for some time. The Marines first proposed this idea in the 1980s. And at the time, they were looking at a slightly different area. They were also wanting to go much lower. They were asking for designated airspace between 500 feet and 18,000 feet, and it was over an area that included Aurora and Bath and Belhaven, little towns down east. That issue, they did it at that point. They did an environmental impact statement. And the issue was referred to a group called the Council on Environmental Quality, which is part of the executive branch of federal government. And the Council on Environmental Quality found that Marine Corps' environmental impact statement was inadequate. So they went back and did a supplemental environmental impact statement, but the issue was dropped. And so back around 2000, they sort of resurrected this idea and have been moving on it since then, doing studies. But one significant difference this time is they didn't do an environmental impact statement. They sent out a notice, they published a notice that they were going to do one, and then they decided to sort of change course and not do one.
And in this case, it's not just the environmental groups that are saying, whoa, you should do an environmental impact statement. It's also another body of government, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
That's right. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said that the environmental assessment, which is what the Marine Corps did, which is a more cursory document, they didn't look deeply enough into the effects on tundra swan and snow geese, which are there are large populations of at these wildlife refuges, the Marine Corps said that because they have some designated airspace currently around the bombing ranges, around the Dare County bombing range, and they fly over some portions of wildlife refuges to get to the bombing range. They said that, you know, there are birds there now, so therefore we don't think it'll be a problem if we get this additional airspace.
Even though they might be flying over many more birds in
Well, that's what the Fish and Wildlife Service pointed out, is that the areas that they're flying over now, while they are part of the wildlife refuge, are not the areas where the birds are, because they're forest or salt marsh or Pocosin. They're not the primary waterfowl areas.
And so this was what went before Judge Terrence Boyle this week. It seemed to center on the environmental impact on wildlife, but I'm wondering, is anybody talking about the impact on the humans on the ground and the human activity in this area? For instance, how loud would these planes be when they're doing their exercises, and how many hours a day would one be very much aware of them?
That's a good question. If they did a full environmental impact statement, they would have to look more carefully at that issue. The studies that the Marine Corps has done so far indicated that they'd be training about 7 hours a day over this large Matamuskete area, and that there would be one sortie, which can be one plane or a group of planes, over the area for 7 hours in any 24 hours. And their documents said that 30% of visitors to the wildlife refuges might experience interference with natural quiet.
Might hear the noise.
Yeah. It said anyone at any point in a wildlife refuge, there might be approximately 20 minutes of aircraft noise per training day.
Do we have a decibel level? Do we know how loud these planes would be?
Well, it depends on the elevation. They're very loud close to the ground.
And how about at 3,000 feet up, which is, I guess, the closest they could come, if I'm reading this correctly?
That's right, which is lower than the current military airspace that they have designated in most of North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Around the bombing range, they can go lower in a couple of places, but most of the area over Pamlico Sound, they have to stay at heights of more like 7,000 feet or 8,000 feet.
If the Marines didn't have this particular airspace, if they didn't get this, where else would these fighter jets practice?
They already have large areas designated for training. They say that those areas are heavily used now and that they need additional space to do training. I mean, one of the things that Judge Boyle asked them about in the court hearing was who's going to be using this space, and the new Super Hornet planes that will be based at Cherry Point and at Oceana Naval Air Station in Virginia would share this airspace with the Marine Corps aircraft. So there would be new planes using this space in addition to the Marine Corps planes.
And of course, Terrence Boyle is the presiding judge as well in the outlying landing field case, a whole separate controversy from this one about where the Navy wants to practice landings and quick takeoffs.
Right, which would be right beside this military operations area that they want.
And when can we expect a decision in either of these?
He now has both cases. He's heard arguments in both cases, and so it's now up to him to issue a decision. He hasn't indicated when he will make a decision. You can never predict what a judge will do, but everyone expects a decision this spring.
Well, Wade, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Glad to be here.
Wade Rollins is a reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer. Soldiers who succeed on the battlefield sometimes face new battles once they're back home. There's one not very often told story, part of U.S. history. It's that of the Bonus Army, thousands of World War I veterans who flocked to Washington in 1932 to demand payment of a bonus that was promised them. Now, these were different times, but the acts of the Bonus Army eventually, it took a few years, changed the public's thinking about what is owed to veterans. Tom Allen chronicles this in the book The Bonus Army, An American Epic, which he co-wrote with Paul Dixon. And Tom Allen is with us this hour on The State of Things. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, the backdrop for the Bonus Army and this huge flocking of veterans to Washington, D.C. in 1932, times were hard. It was the Depression, and the veterans of World War I were asking that a bonus promise them be paid earlier than scheduled because they wanted the money. But there's another backdrop, and that's the way governments have over time treated veterans, going back to Caesar.
Right. Yeah. There's always been a problem with returning warriors. They represent a menace in some ways to the established order. Nobody knows what to do with them. Queen Elizabeth got a whole group organized to run them off the road. They became highwaymen. By the time we get to the Revolution, American Revolution, many of the soldiers wound up not being paid. They surrounded Congress, who, when it was meeting in Philadelphia, jabbed bayonets through the windows and said, "We want our money." And other soldiers had to be sent to get rid of them. And eventually Congress says, look, we're not going to just go to some city. We need a federal enclave. And that's the way Washington, D.C. got started. So it was really veterans who were responsible for the creation of Washington, D.C.
And what you write in the book, The Bonus Army, An American Epic, is how this group of veterans from across the U.S. Got together in 1932, and it took them a couple of years to eventually get their bonus and to change things. And we will be talking about that this hour on The State of Things. Tom Allen is our guest, author of The Bonus Army. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. In the pits of the Depression in the early 1930s, thousands of veterans from across the country made their way to Washington, D.C. They called themselves the Bonus Army, and they wanted the government to speed up payment of a bonus that had been promised to them 8 years earlier by Congress. This Bonus Army was led by Walter Waters. He was a charismatic veteran who set off with a small group from Portland, Oregon in early summer of 1932. That first year, more than 15,000 veterans went to Washington. They set up a shanty town. The government burned it down, and some veterans were killed. They didn't get their way that first year, nor in 1933 or 1934, but in 1936, Congress decided to pay the 3.5 million veterans their bonus. This marked a change in thinking about what is owed to veterans. Less than a decade later, while World War II was still raging, Congress passed the GI Bill. Tom Allen and co-author Paul Dixon have written the story of the Bonus Army in their book. It's called The Bonus Army, An American Epic, and Tom Allen is with us this hour to talk about it. And we are taking your calls this hour as well, because some of these issues relate very much today with another war underway. Our number is 1-877-962-9862 if you'd like to join the conversation. But Tom Allen, let's go back to 1932.
Sure.
And these veterans, it started out with a group out of Portland, Oregon, coming cross country, and I guess picking up a lot more veterans, thousands of veterans.
Yeah, what happened was at a time when unemployment in the United States was running at about 25%, and there were people who hadn't been employed for 2 or 3 years at that point. And all the veterans of World War I knew that they were owed a bonus. Congress had said in 1924, okay, we're going to give you what was called an adjusted compensation. If you worked in a shipyard, say, during World War I, you might be getting $15 a day. If you were a soldier, you're getting $1 a day. So they were trying to make up for it. It dragged on, and finally in 24, the Congress passed it. But they said you're not going to get the bonus until 1945. Because we're going to keep putting money aside for years, and by the time we get to 45, we'll have enough money to pay you. Well, the vets called it a tombstone bonus because they felt a lot of them would be dead. And that was one way to get your bonus, by the way, because it was essentially a kind of an annuity. So when the Depression started, a Congressman Wright Patman, who was a populist out of Texas and himself a veteran, he introduced legislation in Congress to give them the bonus right now when they really needed it. President Hoover violently opposed it, and many other conservative Republican and Democrats opposed it. And this laid-off cannery worker in Portland named Waters said, well, those guys give things to lobbyists in Washington. Let's become lobbyists. And that was his line. He got 150 veterans from the Portland area. They all went down to the rail yards one day in May of 1932. And the railroad men, who were themselves, many of them veterans, just opened the doors of boxcars, and all these guys piled in, and they started heading east to get themselves to Washington. There was very little publicity about it at the beginning, but as they get to the Mississippi River, it's a funny thing about the way America was set up at that time. They were really leaving the America of farms and ranches, where there hadn't been as much agitation, and they're entering the industrial zone of America, where there had been a great deal of agitation. And so the executives of the railroads stopped the free rides at the Mississippi River, coincidentally. And there were some confrontations with police at that point, and the newsreel cameras rushed there, and the newspapers start covering them. And all the veterans in the nation hear stories about the guys heading for Washington, and they say, well, let's do the same. And they started pouring into Washington. By the beginning of June of 1932, there were about 20,000 veterans in Washington, many of them with their wives and children. And the city of Washington not only wasn't ready for them, but it wasn't ready for an integrated group because it was a Jim Crow town at the time. Everything was segregated, but these guys come in integrated.
In other words, black and whites, even though they had not been able to fight together in World War One.
That's
in the
right.
Same
but they were fighting together for the bonus. Mm-hmm. And so there's a wonderful chief of police in Washington named Pelham Glassford, who himself had been the youngest brigadier general in the American Army. And he had been the chief of police in Washington for only a short time. And he decides that they have to be taken care of. The commissioners who were running Washington at that time, there was no mayor, there were three commissioners appointed by Congress, they say, well, do everything to get rid of these guys. And he says, no, I don't want 10,000 or 20,000 angry men in my city. I want to have them organized and I want to do something. So he set up what amounted to the beginning of a camp in a huge area outside official Washington, but still inside the District of Columbia. And that became, they called it a Hooverville, because it was a shanty town. There were Hoovervilles all over the country at that point, where homeless people would just get some wooden boxes and try to find shelter. And he set up an organized camp, found food for them, and they kept pouring into town all that summer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to get to what happened there, because that's very much, it's a key part of the mm-hmm. story about the government's response, soldiers on soldiers. But one of those people who had, one of those veterans who had gone cross country was actually a native North Carolinian.
Yeah,
and wonderful. You have here in front of us, not the actual, the original diary, but Xeroxes of pages from his diary. Tell me his story.
Well, there's a really interesting guy. His name was really Steve Misker. And he ran into a railroad cop somewhere along the line, changed his name to Steve Murray. And we refer to him as Steve Murray in the book. He's hitchhiking around, bumming around the country. He's a veteran. And he heard about the Bonus Army just before it started out. He hitchhikes down. He had a relative living in Oregon. And he got a new pair of shoes from the American Legion. And he goes into Portland just before the Bonus Army sets out. And he keeps a diary. So we were able to reconstruct a lot of the trip. And he stays with the Bonus Army all the way across. He gets to Washington, and he meets, he's from Wisconsin originally. He meets a guy from North Carolina who says, I've got some relatives you ought to meet. They make their way back down to the Asheboro area, and some people there say, well, we want to do something for the Bonus Army. And they put together a string band. They get in two cars and head north. And in his diary, he tells his funny stories about how they make their way back to Washington, where they put on impromptu concerts in Greensboro, in Durham, and they get something like 63 cents at one, and they get $1.23 at another, and they buy gas with it and get themselves to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
That's the story of the diary.
Yeah, yeah. And this was helping you to piece this whole story mm-hmm. together of how these vets get to Washington. So at some point, how many people have descended on Washington? This is veterans and also bringing along sometimes wives, children.
Wives and killed
children. How many people are now in Washington in 1932?
At any one moment, there are probably about 40, 45,000. It stabilizes, gets down to about 20,000 toward the end of the summer. What's happening is they are really lobbying. They're walking into congressional offices as real good, peaceable men. And one of the things I found remarkable is, you know, they're camping out in a mud flat, but they always have clean shirts on. They always, and they're gaunt, they're thin. None of them has a rich watch. They've hocked that a long time ago. But they go in and confront the congressman. And the first crisis is that the bill is locked up in committee, and there needs to be a certain number of congressmen to vote it out. And they go to those congressmen, the congressmen vote it out of committee. When it reaches the floor of the House, it actually passes the House, and the guys think, wow, we're going to get our bonus, which is going to average about $500 or $600 apiece at a time when the median income of an American family was $3,000. So they are, if you had $3,000. And it passes the House. Then it comes up in the Senate, and there's great hostility against it in the Senate. President Hoover is against it, and all of the financial leaders of the Senate say, we can't afford it, it can't be done. So the Senate starts debating it, and it goes into the night. It gets to be about 9 o'clock at night, and veterans have been camping out on Capitol Hill, thousands of them. They are many of them are in a camp across the Anacostia River. There's a drawbridge. The cops have put the drawbridge up so that the 10,000 or so in the camp can't get to Capitol Hill. The commuters go crazy. The cops finally put the bridge back down, and all of a sudden there are 10,000 more veterans heading for Capitol Hill. The senators leave the Senate in tunnels to get away. They're afraid that they're going to storm the Capitol. I mean, they're right there on the lawn outside the Capitol. And then a very remarkable thing happens. The head of the camp, who's been elected by the vets, Waters, has to announce the fact that the Senate has turned it down. About 9 o'clock at night, he says it's all over. And he's afraid to even say it because he's going to set this group going. And there's a Hearst reporter standing there, and she whispers something in his ear, and then he suddenly says, "Sing America, sing America." And this whole group starts singing, and they disperse. It was just a magic moment. They were a peaceful, absolutely peaceful lot, and there's no violence at that point. But there's great concern now because their cause is gone. Their cause is lost. So therefore, it's all over. They should go home. And Waters announces that they're staying. They're never going to go home until they get the bonus. They'll stay to 1945.
So they'll stay in their camp on the Anacostia River.
Yeah. And President Hoover is very concerned about the impact of this on the city. And many of the vets are camped in the center of Washington at the foot of Capitol Hill. There are abandoned buildings there that they have been given permission to occupy the abandoned buildings, half torn down, half demolished. These are going to be torn down for what will become the National Gallery of Art and the Federal Triangle. So they're all there, and Hoover issues the orders, evacuate them. The job is given to the police. The police on July 28th start evacuating them from the buildings. Things have there are problems. There's a scuffle between the cops. But for the most part, it's pretty peaceful. And then suddenly there's some kind of a confrontation between two police officers and a bunch of veterans. Nobody has pulled a gun all day long. And the two cops pull guns, fire at the veterans, kill one, and mortally wound the other. At that point, the police restore order and the evacuation continues, but the White House says, that's it, call out the troops. So General Douglas MacArthur, who is the Army Chief of Staff, has been secretly preparing troops across the river in Fort Myer for riot control. And he gets them going, and across the river comes on mounted cavalry led by no other than George Patton. And they have their sabers flashing. And they also bring in 200 infantrymen with gas masks, bayonets, loaded rifles, and five tanks come rolling down Pennsylvania Avenue. And clouds of tear gas. What has happened also, the people have been listening all day in the radio to things that are happening, and they come down to downtown Washington. So you have not only the veterans there, you have thousands of onlookers, federal workers who have left their office buildings to see what's going on. And all of a sudden there's clouds of tear gas over the center of Washington, and everybody is being driven out of the center of Washington. All the little camps, there were 21 places in the district where there were camps, and the soldiers start setting them on fire, and all of them go up in smoke.
So basically, what the scene you have here are is veterans who 15 years earlier returned home from World War One, and they're facing people in the very uniforms
that they wore in the war.
Yeah,
there's no hesitation on the part of the troops, which is remarkable. But they aren't looked upon by that time as veterans. As they're looked upon as people who are kind of reminding everyone that there's a depression. President Hoover is running for re-election that year, and these veterans are walking advertisements of the depression. Yeah. So he wants them out of his sight, but he does not want MacArthur to cross the Anacostia River and content and hit the big camp, which covers several acres. And MacArthur, about 9 o'clock that night, does cross the river in violation of the orders from the president.
Which kind of presages what happened in World War II with him defying orders, right?
And he goes across the river and sets fire to that camp. Mm-hmm. And they're all driven out in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm. You have in your book, you quote here a black newspaper in Washington, D.C., African-American newspaper, and it reports that there was this, I think after the troops were coming through Anacostia, there were still veterans on that side of the river, and there was one who was holding an American flag and was trying to get in the middle of the street,
right.
But the troops, the younger American troops, the ones that were trying to disperse them, did that, and he's off to the side. And there's a quote here, it's from this newspaper. It reads, "Company after company marched by, not one officer looking up. For the first time in American history, American troops on duty, that would be the soldiers, passed the colors, the flag, held in loyal hands without being called to attention and without giving a salute."
Yeah.
Because it was this veteran holding this flag.
Right. Yeah. He had the sense to see that this was a historic moment, and he really tried something that was would have broken the morale of the – it just would have broken the whole formation. Yeah. But they were really very disciplined troops, and the rumor had been spread that all the veterans were crooks or communists. They really weren't real veterans. They were agitators who were going to try to overthrow the United States government. And I think that was the judgment behind the men saying, I've got a bayonet and I'm going to prod a veteran with it. There's no hesitation whatsoever on the part of anybody.
We're talking with Tom Allen, who is co-author of the new book, The Bonus Army, An American Epic. If you want to join the conversation, our number is 1-877-962-9862. And so it took a couple of years for them to get their bonus because these veterans are then dispersed. They come back in 1933, 1934. FDR, Roosevelt, He's not rushing to give them their money either, though he benefited by Hoover having, done what he did there, did not play very well with the public in the election of 32.
Oh, yeah.
But Roosevelt himself didn't want to give them money.
Well, the day after the expulsion of the veterans, Roosevelt is sitting in Hyde Park. Someone brings in the New York Times, and spread all over the New York Times are the photographs of the burning of the camps and the expulsion of the veterans, and Roosevelt says to an aide, "This will elect me." And of course, he does get elected. The veterans come back in 1933, thinking they've got a friend in the White House now. Well, they don't. The first act of President Roosevelt to adjust balance the budget is to cut veterans' benefits by 40%. and he is no friend of the veterans. He's against the bonus by in principle. They come back in 1934, and again, he tries to get them to go into the Civilian Conservation Corps, but these are guys now in their 40s, and they haven't had a square meal, some of them, in 3 years. And they're no match for the 18-year-old kids who are going to climb in the trees for the CCC. And so in 1935, they invent a new idea, which is a veterans rehabilitation camp. And that introduces a tragic end for the...
It sends them to Florida and to a hurricane, and we'll pick up more on that story with Tom Allen, who is co-author with Paul Dixon of The Bonus Army. We are taking your calls. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. The story of The Bonus Army was captured in songs at the time, such as this one. This is Bumblebee Slim singing "When I Get My Money, I Mean That Bonus" in 1936. More of our conversation just ahead on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. The Bonus Army was a group of thousands of World War I veterans who went to Washington, D.C. in 1932 to demand early payment of a veteran's bonus. This was a racially integrated group of veterans. They camped out in the nation's capital until they were forcibly removed by the U.S. Army. Their story and the legacy they hold for soldiers today is told in the new book, The Bonus Army, An American Epic. We're talking this hour with Tom Allen, who, with Paul Dixon, co-authored that book. And we're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. So, Tom Allen, what happened was they were forced from Washington. Roosevelt comes into office, and he's not going to give them, in the 1930s, he's not going to give them the bonus they were seeking. And the tide turns on this. When he sends them to Florida, the president sends them to Florida to work on some, it was a make-work project to try to make Key West a tourist spot.
Well, Key West is essentially under government control at that time. It's bankrupt. And they have the idea that tourism will save their city. So US-1 is going to be built from Miami all the way down to Key West. The places where you had to take a ferry will be turned into bridges or highway. And they send a group of veterans down there. And in 1935, Labor Day, September 2nd, 1935, the worst hurricane ever to hit the Western Hemisphere wipes them out. There are 250 of them killed. And that's the end of the Bonus Army, this tragic end. One of the people who arrives at the scene very early is Ernest Hemingway from Key West. And he's infuriated because he loved these guys and he had... really had a passion for World War I veterans. And he writes a piece, Who Murdered the Vets? And he says Washington murdered the vets to get him out of Washington. So in the wake of that, Congress says, we've got to give them the bonus. And Roosevelt says, okay, here's what we'll do. I'm still going to vote. I'm going to veto it. I have to in principle. But if you want to overtake the veto, go right ahead. So that's what happens.
I think to our ears today, it's curious that because in the ensuing more than half century, you know, veterans, there have been the benefits. There have been there was the GI Bill that came in World War II, probably as a result of this.
That's we believe that there's the veterans get the GI Bill in World War II because of what happened to the Bonus Army. There are legislators, and one of them being Wright Patman, who was there through the whole process.
And this is while World War II is still going on, saying, okay, when these guys get out, they'll get help with their college education.
Right. And Roosevelt's not too keen on that either.
That's really interesting because I think most people's perception of Roosevelt would be, here's the man who gave us the New Deal. Your government came to the aid of the citizens
but his basic,
in hard times.
His basic principle was that anything that's given by the government should be given to everyone. There shouldn't be special classes inside the American citizenry. And he's holding on to that. And when the concept of the GI Bill, which is really, it's veterans organizations, primarily the American Legion, that gets behind the idea of a GI Bill. Roosevelt, one of the issues is going to be free education, college education. And what Roosevelt embraces at first is we'll give the money to the colleges, not to the individuals. And there's an incredible testimony by Conant of Harvard, Hutchins of University of Chicago, and John Murray Butler of Columbia. They're all against it. In fact, Hutchinson says from the University of Chicago, if you do this, you're going to create educational hobo jungle in American education. They believe that education in college should be reserved to the elite class. And that goes down for the, you know, for the first time. Everyone gets a chance at college. People get a chance to buy homes. And it transforms the middle class of America. And then no one saw that coming.
We go to the phones now. Number is 1-877-962-9862. Shaneer is in Greensboro. Hi there, Shaneer.
Hello.
Yeah.
I want to tell you, I'm one of the people that was transformed by the GI Bill. It was a wonderful thing. Listen, the unifying theme here is the hidden cost of war. I just returned from some veterans counseling for post-traumatic stress disorder, one of the hidden costs. The federal budget, as you know, is now looking at the cutback in 150 social programs. Mm-hmm. You know, and what I'd encourage people to do is call Congress, tell them they're supposed to be the purse strings, ask for some fiscal responsibility, some programs for veterans, and to look at not just the hidden cost, but the real cost of war, and where's the business plan? Where's the revenue for supporting the cost of war, both hidden and unhidden, and not just deferring it to debt later?
Tom Allen?
Yeah, well, you know, hidden is a good word. When we were working on the book, we were kind of curious about why didn't everybody know about this? And we started seeing it as hidden history. Why? Well, if you look at the American story, it's seamless. It starts at the Revolution and comes right up to today. But running along in the margin of the American story is the veteran story. And every once in a while, that's an embarrassing story. And it's rare that the veterans' margin, the marginal aspect of veterans' history, gets itself into the mainstream of American history. And it's usually because of something that's done to the vets, not something that's done for the vets. The one of the curious things, when I was working at Hyde Park, the Presidential Library, FDR, the files on the GI Bill are amazingly thin. I mean, there's much more on all of the other New Deal ventures. The GI Bill, there was no one had any idea that this was going to transform the middle class and make this such a long-lasting benefit. I mean, it's still out there. But now, instead of something that you get when you leave, it's something that they tell you about to get you in.
To entice you to join.
To entice you to join.
Because we have the volunteer army now.
Well,
Shaneer, does that jive with what you're thinking?
One of the other issues here, you know, if we look just a wee bit into the future, let's say it's 10 years later that the current president has come to something like the current president did yesterday in Raleigh. What's the opportunity for a large group of veterans and other displaced pensioners that we've seen in other countries to try to stage some sort of, provoke some sort of change in government, legal or even not legal? We don't know what the future's bring, and as long as we keep deferring these hidden costs and not telling the hidden stories, we're just putting the pressure cooker on. Thank you for telling of the story.
Okay, thanks for your call, Shaneer.
Thank you.
1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. Currently, in the past couple of weeks and months, there has been this effort to increase some of the benefits. I don't know if that's the exact word we want to use here, because we're talking about the death benefits that go to families of soldiers who are felled in Iraq. Life insurance going from $250,000 to $400,000, and something that's called the death gratuity, whose name I'm still trying to wrap myself around, going from $12,000 to $100,000. That takes care of those people who've lost their loved one in the war. But what about the veterans who are coming back?
We're seeing. I talked to someone actually just last night about the issue of what's going on in the veterans' hospitals. They didn't see this coming, and they're ramping up as fast as they can.
I mean, loss of limbs. And
yeah,
so forth.
And the need for long term health care for veterans. It's a very foggy area. It varies now from state to state because of the way the Veterans Administration is running things through the states. So some veterans in some states are coming out of the war and getting into VA hospitals and getting into the VA health system rapidly, and others are on long, long waiting lists. And there isn't the agitation one would expect from Congress. And I have a theory about this, which is probably a little controversial. But if you look at Congress down through the ages, starting right after the American Revolution and continuing up into the Vietnam War, you couldn't run for election if you weren't a veteran. It was almost a requisite. So Congress was full of veterans of whatever the war was a few years before. When you got to the Vietnam War, those of us who remember it, there was a lot of talk about very few kids who were the sons of members of Congress got into the war. The whole class structure.
As is the case today.
Yeah, and it's certainly true today. But not only that, there were relatively few in Congress and in elsewhere in the administration. There isn't that input of guys who were veterans, and that is diluting the process. So if you call Congress your congressman today, you've got a pretty good chance you're not talking to someone who served in the United States Armed Forces.
Mm-hmm. And this is all about it's economics, because there's not an unending supply of money about what you give. But money had been given to those who perished in 9/11.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what got the interest in the. It's a tough subject, but I think it is what got the death gratuity, as they call it, increased, is because people were seeing that people who died in Twin Towers were getting very large sums. I mean, the next of kin. And here are soldiers who were dying.
And getting $12,000. The family getting $12,000. Yeah. So there was that change because of the bonus army, and those people eventually, it was 3.5 million veterans back in the mid-30s, they got the money.
Right.
And that prompted that change of thinking about the GI Bill later mm-hmm. on.
Yeah, one of the things that they did come up with is we'll do it again. We'll give them a kind of a bonus. And that was on the table for a short time during World War II. But there were some far-sighted legislators at that time, many of them veterans of World War I, who said, no, we got to do something that is more substantial. That's a transformational reward. And that's where the idea of giving them money for college and setting up a business or buying a home came in.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about some of the players in the bonus army. Walter Waters, mm-hmm. who had been a veteran of World War I, he managed to bring a mostly peaceable group
yep.
to Washington. But his history took a very sharp turn a decade later.
Yeah, it's very interesting. He had a kind of interest in a kind of Gandhi peaceful demonstration. And somewhere along the line, when he's so frustrated by what happens in Washington that he announces one day that he's going to start an organization called the Khaki Shirts. Well, shirts was a kind of metaphor at that time, because there were the black shirts in Italy and the silver shirts, which is an anti-Semitic, anti-black group in the United States. So if you were going to give a color to a shirt, it was indicating you were going into a fascist kind of mode. And he starts a fascist organization called the Khaki Shirts. It didn't really get anywhere. But he then kind of disappears. Then he reappears. And lo and behold, General MacArthur hires him to be a clerk in the War Department. And then when World War II comes, he reenlists in the service, and he does serve in World War II.
In which theater did he?
Basically in the United States. Yeah, it gets a little murky at that point. And then he just absolutely disappears. Paul and I tracked down his obituary. The obituary is about 3 lines long. No mention of the bonus army in the obituary.
Mm-hmm. It seems like a rather... Before your book, I had not heard of this. I think a lot of people may not have, rather.
Right.
But it seemed like a pivotal point in our history,
yeah,
at least in the treatment of veterans.
I really do feel that when we first looked at it, Paul and I thought that it was an episode, an interesting episode during the Depression. But then when we see them come back in 33, 34, 35, then we started realizing that this was a long road, and that when the New Deal comes in, the New Deal doesn't know how to handle the veterans. And I think there were people who said, if you can't handle veterans this long after a war, what are you going to do now with a war that's going on? And that's where the GI Bill gets debated, actually, while World War II is going on. In fact, in some ways, it was the D-Day landings on June 6th of 1944 that got the Congress to start moving. It was kind of percolating at that point. But with the D-Day landings and the beginning of the liberation of Europe, The tide had turned. There was no question that the war, the end of the war, was probably in sight at that point. It would go on to 1945. But the Congress says we've got to do something right now. We have 15 million guys coming home this time, not 4 million. And 15 million is a very large number. And we can't have them all come in and say, what are you doing about the life I've got now?
I wonder, too, if on the flip side of that, if it might have been those who perished there at D-Day, because there were just huge numbers of men who died trying to storm the beach, just as 250 veterans dying in that hurricane in 1935 turned the tide on getting the bonus. And there were photographs of many of those bodies of those veterans, which publicly turned the tide.
Yeah, people did know we've got to do something for people making that kind of a sacrifice. And Congress quickly eliminated the idea of a pension because that had been the solution after the Civil War. And then came the solution of the bonus after the First War. And they knew they didn't want to do that again. And then a man who was himself a veteran of World War I, who was a national commander of the American Legion, he goes to the Mayflower Hotel. He comes to Washington to do some lobbying about what are we going to do about the veterans. He goes to the Mayflower Hotel, and on a piece of Mayflower stationery, he puts down education, houses, and it's the first draft of the GI Bill of Rights. And once that is out of the bottle, it's very hard for any congressman to be against it. But there were congressmen against it at the very beginning, and they were for predominantly Southern congressmen who didn't like the idea of the same kind of money going to blacks as going to whites. And in some ways, it's the beginning of integration in the United States, because all of a sudden there's a federal program that is not going to discriminate between African Americans and white Americans. And they're going to go to school. Everybody's going to go to school. And that whole process was one of those wonderful things, that unexpected results. Nobody saw that one coming, but that's one of the results of the GI Bill.
Right. Well, Tom Allen, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Welcome. It was a pleasure.
Tom Allen is co-author with Paul Dixon of The Bonus Army, an American Epic. He reads from the book tonight at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, and on Sunday you can hear him read at McIntyre's Books in Farrington Village. And for today, that's the state of things. If you have a comment about our program, our email address is sot@wunc.org. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thanks for listening. I'm Melinda Pencava.